Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Seamus Heaney started working with the original text of Beowulf, he was translating Old English into new, words first written down perhaps 1,000 years ago. When Heaney more recently turned his poet's talents to the translation of Sophocles, he was looking at material 2,400 years old. But no less connected to our literature and our theater today, the Greek language and those Sophoclean tragedies are a part of the way that we write and think. Invariably, though, there is a bit of connective tissue that needs to be found to help make that link between what was written thousands of years ago and what we understand today. Heaney's talent as a student of the classics and the master of myth and storytelling lies in discovering that tissue. Today we'll talk about those links and we invite you to join us. How ready are you to be taken back to the theater, to the time of the ancient Greeks? And how much license will you give a poet like Seamus Heaney to take you there? Do you favor the more formal, more literal translation of the classics or something that sings in the language of today? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney. He is in the studio with me this hour. His most recent work is called The Burial at Thebes, a version of Sophocles' Antigone. A version, meaning that you took a little bit of license with the story?
Well, I didn't take so much license, no, but I would reserve the word translation for work where I know the original language, more or less, you know. In Anglo-Saxon, I had studied Anglo-Saxon of Beowulf. I tussled with the glossaries. So I would call that a translation. I was shy of calling this a translation because I don't know ancient Greek. But I used older versions. There's a Victorian version by a scholar called Jebb. There's another scholarly version in the Loeb edition where you have parallel texts. You see where the meter changes, the line length changes, and so on. So that's why I called it a version. But actually, it's fairly direct. There's nothing imported or deported from the content.
Nobody who lives in yours who died in
the
original. Just for those people who need a bit of a Cole's Notes on Antigone here, we have two warriors, both brothers, fighting against each other in a battle for Thebes, right?
That's right. Well, I called it The Burial at Thebes. There's a change. For 2.5 millennia, the play has been known as Antigone. I wanted to refresh it, partly because I had called another play I did by Sophocles. It was usually called Philoctetes. I called it The Cure at Troy. So there was a little kind of symmetrical thing in The Burial at Thebes. But burial is at the center. The issue of burial, which involves the sacred right of the human creature and his or her family, the intimacy factor in human life. Burial has to do with that, with what Antigone would have called the law of the gods. Who owns a body? In the first burial that is central to the play is one that takes place, or rather does not take place, when Antigone's brother, who is, you're quite right, came to fight against Thebes. We needn't go into the whole plot. She has two brothers, one who defends the city of Thebes, where her father and their father was Oedipus the king, and one who comes to attack it with the forces of Argos. He's a kind of traitor. He's not a patriot. And these terms echo throughout the play. So he comes to attack, he's defeated, and the king of Thebes, Creon, the ruler, says, "No burial for you. You are outside the city. You have disgraced yourself. You put yourself beyond the pale." So
he went further than that. He forbade anybody in the kingdom.
Indeed, he forbade
to go anywhere near the body. Forbade, to leave it for the dogs.
That's right. Leave it out to be eaten by the dogs as carrion, not to be given any of the sacred rites. So that's the first burial at issue. Antigone disobeys the order, because she believes the sacred rite, both R-I-G-H-T and R-I-T-E, are there for have to be performed.
Now, Antigone is the sister of these two brothers, mm-hmm. and you know, is happy to have one buried, and decides to challenge Creon on his order that her other brother not be buried. I'm curious to know if, in our understanding of the play today, it's dramatically different from the way it would have been seen by a Greek audience 2.5 millennia ago. Because here you have this very strong-minded, strong-willed woman standing up to the ruler saying, "I'm not going to obey what you, you know, your rule. I'm going to do it my way." And she's a sympathetic character immediately to us. I don't know whether or not she was in the original Sophocles play.
I suppose in post-romantic Europe, or in the world of the West, so to speak, the idea of the standing up for individual human rights and rebellion, the idea of rebellion, is sanctioned much more than it would have been in 5th century BC Athens. Nevertheless, the Greeks would have had a religious sense that put them, that balanced evenly. They would have had a strong sense, I think, of the necessity for order in the polis, in the city. Mm-hmm. The government, the corporation, the government of the city had to be obeyed. But they would have an equally strong sense of the sacred right, the sacred need, the sacred obligation to bury the dead. So as ever in drama, there's the conflict of two rights. And that's why Sophocles is such a great playwright, that he establishes early on, which is what we call a classic, I guess, a work that establishes a dilemma or a question that preoccupies generations, and it becomes new in every generation. In Ireland, we had specifically in Northern Ireland, and I was interested in the play because Antigone just wasn't a text that was taught in school. Of course, it was taught in school, but when I was taught it in the 1950s and 60s, we talked about the unities of time and place. We talked about Aristotle's idea of what tragedy was. We talked about it in a very literary way. But by the 1970s in Ireland, the play Antigone and the question of whether you disobeyed or obeyed the rule of law in the society was high on the agenda. Civil rights, in other words, the civil rights movement began, sit-downs where the police removed you. So the question of whether you cause bother within the settled society for the sake of what you believe to be a sacred right came alive, and Antigone was invoked. And of course it was played in Nazi-occupied Paris. It was allowed to be played in a version by Jean Anouilh because the censor thought, I suppose the German censor, the occupying force, thought this is a play where law and order gets its say. And the French Libération people thought this is a play where resistance gets its say. So it's a true drama in that way. It establishes the coordinates of the problem.
There's a story that you tell at the end of the play itself about a moment when you found the music for your version of Antigone. I'm avoiding the use of the word translation.
Well, whatever. Yes.
but it's a great story because you actually go through the same process of trying to find that key to unlocking Beowulf. And it's a verb that you find from 1,000 years ago that you hear your own ancestors using. You go, aha,
there is a connection. That's right,
And in this case, what were you looking for? What couldn't you find?
Well, I didn't know how to begin. I mean, I had several texts. To tell you the truth, Antigone has been translated very often in Ireland in the last few years. I mean, the last 15 years, been very good versions by poets and so on. But the Abbey Theatre, which is our national theatre, which is our equivalent, say, of the Globe Theatre or the Moscow Art Theatre, 100 years old this year, great founding fathers, W.B. Yeats, Lady Gregory, Sean O'Casey and so on. So the Abbey was celebrating themselves and the 100th anniversary. They asked me to do Antigone. I thought, it's been done so often, can I do it? On the other hand, there are three Theban plays by Sophocles. There's Oedipus the King, Oedipus at Colonus, and Antigone. W.B. Yeats had done Oedipus the King and Oedipus at Colonus for the Abbey. So I thought it was a great honour to be complete the trilogy. But still, there was the material, but there was nothing to get started. I mean, it's like tuning fork, as far as I'm concerned. If you're going to do it in verse, and there was no point in me doing it in prose because I had no... I mean, if you're going to do it in prose, go to the Greek and reconstruct. I wanted to put energy, verse energy, speakability, a kind of spine into the speech. And then just the night before I went down to say to the director, artistic director, I remember this poem in the Irish language, spoken by a woman over an unburied man. which is precisely the situation of Antigone.
Her husband, was it? Was
her husband, yes. Her name was Evelyn Duvney Chonel, and she was married to a man called Art O'Leary. Art O'Leary was a sassy, as I call him, a sassy pre-emancipation Catholic. Anyway, he troubled the English authorities. For one reason or another, he was shot, left on the roadside. The horse came galloping back to the house. She sees the blood on the bridle. She goes to the side of the road, finds him. And then, excuse me, at the wake, she speaks this poem. It was a tradition of keening, of spontaneous lamentation over the dead. And it's a famous poem in the Irish language. I had learnt it at school, and I remember the cadence. It goes, the opening lines, which I remember, are Mogra go dangan ho, la the wakahu, kyunti and warigi, hug mhoil aragit, hug mhri tidin of ditch, delia some carrot lat, a wa the walilat. It's kind of pleading and repetitive. And in the English translation by Frank O'Gord, my love and my delight, the day I saw you first before beside the market house, I had eyes for nothing else and love for none but you. I left my father's house and ran away with you. These three beat lines have a little bit of panic, a little bit of passion in them. And the play begins with Antigone and her sister in slight panic with passionate things to say. So I just went straight into it, very plain. Ismene, quick, come here. What's to become of us? Why are we always the ones? Daughters of Oedipus. So that got us started. And otherwise, and I could continue with that, you know.
Do you then make adjustments when Creon takes the stage and makes his kingly pronouncements on justice and his right to rule?
Yeah.
Does he have the same...
Different pace. Actually, there are three different paces, three different ground musics. For Antigone, that and for the choruses, the heightened speech of feeling, in her case, is that they call it, technically speaking, a trimeter, 3 foot line, three stresses. Magra, good dang it. As many, quick, come here. But for Creon, just the traditional Shakespearean middle ground, middle of the road English blank verse line, titum, 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 titum. I think he says, I can find words for his anywhere.
You know, we should hold off on that because we've got to take a break in about a minute and a bit. And it's something I'd like to not rush you through. So you have the king.
And then the chorus. The choruses speak wisdom. They kind of, they stand between the passion of Antigone and the kind of patriarchal rule of Creon. And they sort of adjudicate. They are the meditating head, you think, of the playwright. So they're more like freestanding poems about the nature of justice, what's called for in a good society, what the rights and wrongs are, generally speaking.
My guest this hour is Seamus Heaney. We're talking about those big issues, as he puts them in his latest translation of Antigone. He calls it a version of Sophocles' Antigone, The Burial at Thebes. And there are, in fact, some interesting political parallels to what's been going on in this country. We'll have a chance to talk a little bit about those when we come back, as well as the poet, as translator, as storyteller. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. As Seamus Heaney says, the original version of Antigone has been translated numerous times. What we're talking about on the program today is his own version of the play, called The Burial at Thebes. Seamus Heaney is winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1995, author of a number of books of poetry, including Fieldwork, The Spirit Level, Open Ground, Electric Light. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, your chance to join our conversation this hour about the what connects Sophocles and Heaney. the words of the king, yeah. I guess what I'm curious to know is, in the Sophoclean version, were the words meant to be these booming pronouncements from the stage, whether they were the king or the chorus? Was it meant to sound a little bit like the language of the moment? Because your story is so much in our language.
Yeah.
It's so accessible for that.
Well, I think that the actual language was slightly more elevated. First of all, the actors wore masks, which changes things. It was in the open air. It began at dawn. This play begins at dawn, and it would have been in the Theatre of Dionysus, stadium basically, with thousands on the seats at the religious feast. It was kind of a Thanksgiving or a Christmas time moment, and so the whole community was gathered around, and these people came out in their masks, and of course there was a chorus of, I think, was it 12, 24 people dancing. There was music, so it was a ritual event. It was elevated. In fact, there's something to be said for doing these things with masks, but it doesn't happen. Given that it doesn't happen, you have actors now speaking barefacedly, as it were. So the language and the conventions of our age dictate a more direct thing. Mm-hmm. But that's the reason I wanted to keep some verse, whether it's whatever kind of verse it is, it ritualizes it ever so slightly. And Creon speaks more or less blank verse, like the Shakespearean blank verse, until a man has passed this test of office. I mean,
Can you read us a bit of him? Where does this come? Is this Creon defending his right to make the
decision? Is this Creon announcing to the city that he has the right to lay down the law and about the nature of kingship? He has just assumed the kingship, and he's talking about responsibility, being responsible for the good order of a society, for the security of it, for the running of it. And he says, until you've done this, he says, until a man has passed this test, you can't be sure of him, what his mind and heart and capabilities are, he says. Worst, he says, is the man who has all the good advice, and then, because his nerve fails to act in accordance with it, as a leader should. And equally to blame is anyone who puts the personal above the overall thing, puts friend or family first. But, says Creon, rest assured, my nerve's not going to fail, and there's no threat that's ever going to stop me acting, ever, in the interest of all citizens. Nor would I ever have anything to do with my country's enemy. For the patriot, personal loyalty always must give way to patriotic duty. Solidarity, friends, is what we need. The whole crew must close ranks. The safety of our state depends upon it. Our trust, our friendships, our security, good order in the city, and our greatness. Well, you can imagine that being spoken from many a news conference.
I can't imagine, though, that when you were going through this, that you weren't also thinking of, you know, the same sorts of, yes, you are with us or you are against us.
Of course.
Stand with the state or stand,
yes,
against us. Words that had come from President Bush.
Yes, it was sheer coincidence. The war in Iraq was being prepared, being plied. President Bush was basically doing to the electorate, to the houses in Washington, and to the allies or to the world, what Creon is doing to the chorus. He's working them into a position where if they disagree, they sound as if they are disloyal to the principles of good order. It sounds as if they are supporting terrorism, if you like. The citizens of Thebes, if they disagree with Creon, he says to them, well, are you supporting her for burying a traitor? So we have a Patriot Act here that, and the word patriot is a proper translation of what Creon is asking for, patriotism, a noble virtue. But there is, and this is again something I'm deeply familiar with in Ireland, Northern Ireland, in any deeply divided situation, in order for people to gain political advantage, whether they are at the top of the pile or at the bottom of the pile, but more especially at the bottom, solidarity is called for. You close the ranks, you make a move, and if somebody says other, they're seen as betraying the cause. So personal integrity and political effectiveness, or the call to be politically effective and the call to maintain your personal integrity, also often are at war in the soul, you know. So it's a perennial spiritual problem for the individual in political movement.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Arlington, Massachusetts for a call from Chris. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Mr. Heaney. I'm actually a good friend of an acquaintance of yours.
Uh-huh.
Fred Marchant.
Oh, yes.
Does somebody owe somebody money here, Chris?
Not yet.
All right.
I'm calling with, I was sort of listening to you speak, and I was thinking, I myself am working on a project related to Sophocles. I'm working on a collection of poems focusing on Ajax.
Oh, yes.
And I was thinking in general of Sophocles' extant works and how really almost prophetic he was. I was thinking of what the speech you were just talking about by Creon and, you know, about President Bush's recent victory speech after the election. And it's almost a direct echo. I mean, mm-hmm. It's amazing just how relevant it is. And I find that, that is true of, you know, almost all of the Greek authors, really. When I go back, I find that the same, which I mean, it's true of the human predicament, I imagine.
The word that you were using just before we went to Chris's call, Seamus, and is loyalty. And to me, that's the one that kind of gets at it. Who are you loyal to? Are you loyal to your country? Mm. Are you loyal to your religion? Are you loyal to your brother, to your family, to your husband-to-be? I mean, those are the questions that he's posing.
Yes, and another place that these questions arose urgently was in South Africa. And I just read recently an essay by Nadine Gordimer, where she makes a distinction between loyalty and integrity. And she says loyalty is a lesser command, you know, than the command to integrity. I was using the terms political solidarity and spiritual freedom or whatever. But these all overlap. And I'm interested, Chris, talking about Ajax. The Ajax is about a great warrior who goes ape. You know, he slaughters animals when he thinks he's slaughtering people. Then he comes to. As a matter of fact, I've just done a version of a speech of Ajax myself, Tech Mesa speech, Chris. So we're crossing paths there too.
Maybe a bit. Yeah. In competition. There's a speech. There's a part of the play by Antigone, the woman herself, who tries to explain what it is that she sees at stake here. And perhaps it'd be useful if we could get you to sort of put it in your version there. Can I get you to do that for
us? Well, this is going towards the second burial. The first burial didn't happen. The second burial is going to happen. Antigone's going to be buried alive for disobeying. And at this point, I elevated her from panic three beat lines to a more dignified iambic pentameter. So her
tone would have changed. Yes, instead of being the sort of furious woman outside the gates of the city, she's now.
This is now a heroine's declaration. Well, no, actually, this is our first declaration of principle to her position as opposed to Creon's. She says to him, I disobeyed because the law, that is the law you made, Creon, I disobeyed because the law was not the law of Zeus, nor the law ordained by justice, justice dwelling deep among the gods of the dead. What they decree is immemorial and binding for us all. The proclamation had your force behind it, but it was mortal force, and I, also a mortal, I chose to disregard it. I abide by statutes utter and immutable, unwritten, original, God-given laws. Was I going to humour you or honour gods? Sooner or later I'll die anyhow, and sooner may be the better in my case. This death penalty is almost a relief. If I had to live and suffer in the knowledge that Polynices was lying above ground, insulted and defiled, that would be worse than having to suffer any doom of yours. You think I'm just a reckless woman, but never, Creon, forget. You yourself could be the reckless one.
Seamus Heaney reading from his version of Sophocles' Antigone. It's called The Burial at Thebes. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. To Gloucester, Massachusetts next. Mark's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, gentlemen. Mr. Heaney and Mr. Gordon, it's a pleasure to talk to you both. I'm really looking forward to reading this, and it reminds me a little bit, Mr. Heaney, what you're saying about this being a version and not a translation of Robert Lowell and his imitations, which he did as sort of not quite faithful but to the letter, but to the spirit translations of poetry. I think there's a production of this play of yours going to be done up by a theater company in Salem. I'm hoping that's going to happen soon. But my question has to do with is connected to your translation of Beowulf. I read your translator note at the beginning, and I love the first word of that translation,
yes.
Which is, I can't say it in the original, it was something like Huet.
Huet, yes, yes.
Which you translated, in the, as you said, as I recall, in the big-voiced scullions or
yes,
something of,
yes.
of Ireland. And you, so you translated as so.
Yes.
Which you talked about, it was a perfect way of gathering attention and also of saying that there's been some history to conversation. I love that. I just thought it was a brilliant, who am I to say so? But anyway, in my humble way, I thought it was a brilliant first moment. I wondered if there were similar moments out of the translation here of Antigone, Burial at Thebes, that you felt delighted by, as I felt delighted by your translation of Quiet or whatever.
Well, perhaps in the choruses, I don't think there are similar moments. That was... That's kind of a one single monosyllable that can cause a lot of bother, you know. But there's no monosyllable in the Antigone version. But there is an intonation, which is the intonation of my elders. I mean, I spoke of those scullions. They were relatives of my father. It wasn't their dialect in particular that... It wasn't the kind of words they used. It was their manner of speech, which was grave and simple. And it was often proverbial. And in writing the choruses of where these elders of the city of Thebes, you know, lay down the law or ponder what's right and what's wrong, they have a kind of proverbial sense. So, I mean, there is a chorus where they begin, "Whoever has been spared the worst is lucky," you know, and that is true to the Greek content, but it's the kind of thing that would have been said at the end of lanes or at wakes after somebody had been killed in a car accident or something. You know, whoever has been spared the worst is lucky. And at the very end of the play, as a matter of fact, the very last chorus, which is final grave wisdom, it could have been spoken by elders, farmers. Good. Well, this is pretty conservative, and that suits the small farm wisdom. Wise conduct is the key to happiness. Always rule by the gods and reverence them. Those who overbear will be brought to grief. Fate will flail them on its winnowing floor, and in due season teach them to be wise. I could hear that in a South Derry accent any day, you know.
My guest is the poet, Seamus Heaney. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones to Knoxville, Tennessee. And Avery is with us from there. Hi, Avery.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I had a question. I'm an English major in a college in southeast Tennessee, and we just finished studying Beowulf. And
who's Beowulf? Do you recall?
Seamus Heaney's Beowulf.
Okay, right. Just checking.
Okay.
And taking off from that, and of course this new translation version. I had a question: is how do you deal with? I'm sure authors throughout history have taken liberties and created their own words to fit, yeah, you know, the sources they did. Shakespeare did it. I'm sure the Greeks did it. How do you, as a translator, deal with words that are only found in that author's text as you're trying to translate them? How do you deal with those unique words?
Well, you mean like something like weird in Anglo-Saxon, W-Y-R-D, the word... For fate or destiny. I mean, if you're translating, the other language contains many words that are only there, but there are key concepts like justus dike or whatever in Greek and weird in Anglo-Saxon. The best you can do, I think, is to obey the traditional glossaries. It's very hard to get another word for fate or destiny. I mean, I'm speaking now of Anglos of the Beowulf. Justice. It may have had different inflections for people in Anglo-Saxon times. In Anglo-Saxon times, justice might have involved killing the man who killed your brother. And in fact, in Greek tragedy, in Aeschylus, one of the founding texts of Western literature is where you move from a place where justice means taking blood for blood, and go to a court where some other kind of mitigation or rule can happen. So you're quite right to raise the question. There are those conceptual, central central concepts, like just to take weird from Anglo-Saxon and justice from the Greek, which you want to refresh them, but it's very hard to find an actual word, a verbal equivalent that is new. There is pleasure quite often in finding, I can't think of anything now, but in finding fresh ways to say what was already there, you know, to find new ways for what's in the dictionary. I was just at a talk given by a colleague of mine at Harvard last week about Beowulf, about this very thing. Anglo-Saxon scholars, specialists in Beowulf, people who have taught the poem and who know it by heart and who love it in the original, they would have had many objections to what I did. And Professor Donoghue, who was giving this talk, said rightly that the person who knows and loves the original, when they read a translation, it reminds them of the original. So if you go too far in modernizing it, you are offending. People who don't know the original, on the other hand, if you go too far in being conservative and use the old language, it doesn't come alive to them. So the translator is on the borderline between fidelity to the old and transporting it forward into the new time.
Helps to be a poet and to have the latitude that you learn as a poet.
It certainly does help, yes. I agree. But it also helps, I think, because if you're a poet, you're caring for making people believe what they hear, as I say. Because a lexical equivalent, the construing of the sense, isn't necessarily the conveying of the total thing. I mean, we don't have masks, we don't have dance, but we do have verse, we can make it move in that way.
All right, Connection listeners, which would be your preference, to stick with the original or to find a way in on something that you might have not thought very accessible? Telephone numbers 1-800-423-8255. Seamus Heaney is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new work, The Burial at Thebes. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Seamus Heaney is here with me in the studio. He is perhaps best known for his translation of Beowulf. We're talking about a translation, a brand new translation, this one of Antigone called The Burial at Thebes. You did say about Beowulf in an interview or something that I read after the fact that at the end it was about a third Heaney and two-thirds whoever was the original author or authors of Beowulf. Would you make the same kind of balance in working with Sophocles' work as well, that it ends up in devising the new music, the new meter, about a third you?
I don't know how to answer the question precisely. I mean, I may have said
it's not
a
mathematical question so much.
It's a matter of the call. There's a double obligation, I think. If your self-respect depends upon sounding like yourself, which is what a writer is, you know.
Okay.
You know, if you don't sound like yourself in your own ear, stop, you know. So, but in a translation, you have to some way give the other guy a break to
share the voice a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So, inevitably, one's intonation is there. Yeah, inevitably. I couldn't be pleased with it if it didn't. But I would never, I think, write a poem my own that goes, "Is many quick come here," you know. The material is honoured, I think. So, two-thirds, one-third, fine.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's not a computer printout. It's a voice printout. It's a voicing by this voice, yeah.
We're going to go to Charlottesville, Virginia for our next call. Mary Ann's on the phone. Hi, Mary Ann.
Yes, thank you. I remember when I read Antigone first, I was about 15 or 16, and I remember it as a very powerful experience. I think partly because here was a young woman who seemed absolutely in balance with this figure of great authority, Creon, and because of her integrity and because what you just said, that self-respect requires that you sound like yourself. Mm-hmm. She is exhibiting self-respect. And I wonder whether you would comment about that, that it is a young woman who is defying this great figure of authority, and how that would have been perceived in Greece at the time, and just any comment you would make on that.
Yeah, it is perceived by Creon in the play as a bit of a scandal. I mean, he says, you know, am I to be take orders from the woman of the house and so on? And the play, of course, is by now as much about it's a feminist text as much as it is a revolution. I mean, a political revolutionary text. So it's about confrontation with the patriarchy, certainly, and that is present in the actual substance of the arguments here and there. I think that the Greek perception of drama, it lodged in the realm of the mythological, you know, and I don't think they would have seen it as a gender war play, but we can. But there was, on the other hand, you could point out the inferior status of woman in Athenian society, if that was the case. We think it probably was, yeah. But I think that the sociological conditions under which the citizen woman lived, and the spiritual, the phantasmagoria, as W. B. Yeats would call it, of the play, in the phantasmagoria of the play, the woman, mythical Antigone, looms and speaks forcefully. She isn't marginalized. She isn't reduced in majesty or integrity or poetic power. In fact, she's probably more. She's the most original, unsilenceable voice for those values in literature, really.
Marianne, are you still there?
Yes.
You know, I had some of the same thoughts as I was reading it, simply because I was thinking to myself, okay, if it had been a young man confronting the king in the same way that Antigone confronts him, you know, it wouldn't quite have had that same tension.
Yes, although it does go beyond that, simply as a presentation of the ability of the powerless to stand up and with integrity and with wholeness and with self-respect become as powerful as the person opposed. So although certainly I can see the feminist argument, but I think what particularly appealed to me was because it was a young woman, but also that it was a powerless person.
Yes.
I mean, and as you say, if it had been a young man, it would have been more limited, I think, in its impact. It had such a powerful impact, I think, because of that.
Also, I think there's the sisterly factor, which is very
yes.
potent in the
yes.
in the actual affect of the play.
Yes.
Ismene, the sister says, look, she's in the beginning says, Antigone, you're mad. Are you hot headed or cold hearted? She says, in my translation or version. And but so she says, no. This isn't the way to do it. You must obey. You'll bring destruction upon yourself. Then at the end, when Ismene sees the majesty and beauty of this protest, she wants to join her, and but Antigone disallows her. Nevertheless, Ismene's position is tenable. Mostly, that's what good, bewildered citizens do. They obey the law. And I remember Conor Cruise O'Brien in a very famous article about our situation in Northern Ireland, which I keep coming back to, but he's saying, you know, is it better in the city of Derry, which was gerrymandered, where there were manifest injustices in the running of the city? He said, this is not a matter just of citizenry here. This is a matter of the relationship between the conquered and the conqueror. And there's a lot of latent, frozen violence here. And is it worth thawing the violence for the sake of a few electoral reforms? Is it not? And in the beginning, he implicitly favoured the acceleration and purity of the protest. But 5 or 6 years, even just then, 300 or 400 people had died. He said, maybe human dignity is better served by Ismene's compromise and swallowing pride. The beauty of this play is that it is distressfully unresolved at any point in history, you know.
What 1-800-423-8255. Thanks for that, Marianne. To Baton Rouge, Louisiana next, and Juliet's on the line. Hi, Juliet.
Hi, Juliet Lockwood, daughter of poet Margot Lockwood.
Hello, Juliet.
Hello, Seamus. I've had a cup of tea with you in Brooklyn.
And did you?
I wanted to give you the thumbs up on making a gallant attempt at translating something so complicated. Yeah. But I would like to just comment as a visual artist that I believe when you appropriate things from the masters, I think that we owe our own, I guess, spiritual journey the right to say you have created your own masterpiece. So I just wanted to give you the thumbs up, and I'm right now in the middle of something called Paradiso, and it is an appropriation of, you know, Homer. So I'm having a nice time painting about those things, so I'm very inspired by what you're doing.
The point is, Juliet, it becomes something new, that it's not, even though Seamus would say it, a version of it, it ends up being something new, doesn't it?
Well, I believe it will be its own masterpiece.
Move it forward. Keep it on the move, yeah.
It's going to be translated again in 100 years.
In 1 year. That's the thing.
Juliet.
Thanks, Juliet.
Thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. And where are we going next? Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Richard's on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. My name is Richard McElvain. I'm an actor and a director in Boston. And coincidentally, I did my own adaptation of Antigone this summer, and we produced it this fall at the Nora Theater in Boston. And it was an enormous experience for everyone involved, and here I found myself coincidentally had just gone down the same path as Mr. Haney, who I am an enormous fan of, I got into it initially because it seems so politically contemporary. Here we have a leader who is overreaching and compromising individual rights and will not admit he's wrong. It seemed like it was ripped from the headlines, but then the deeper I got into the play, I got less and less interested in the politics and more deeply into a larger question that I think Sophocles talks about in several of his plays, which is the idea of self-knowledge. And it seems like that's Creon's great folly and Antigone's, that they are stubborn to the exclusion of listening to anyone or knowing who they are or what they're doing.
Richard, I thank you for the call. You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Self-knowledge?
Yes. I mean, the literature surrounding Antigone, the scholarly literature, makes, understandably, much of that question going too far. The word I use in the version translation is overbearing. You know, they both are overbearing creatures, and there's no doubt about that. It's the tragedy. The tragedy is that they both keep going, you know, head on. They have foot to the floor in their own sense of being right. And it's just a collision. And Creon certainly will not have self-knowledge until the very end. The great figure in this, of course, he hasn't been mentioned yet, is the Tiresias figure, the prophet. There's a turn comes in Creon's being when this religious figure, basically, he's a or prophet, poet, whatever, soothsayer, really.
Yeah, I saw him as I heard him as more secular than religious.
That's right. But he has got that aura of more than usual reliability, and he's a scare factor hanging over him, too. So soothsayer, yeah. And he it is who touches Creon's deepest sense, I suppose we would call it unconscious now. And there's yet another phrase that I'm very, very fond of, spoken by the poet Ted Hughes, speaking of the affect of poetry and the area from which it springs, and the area to which it appeals. He said it's the place of ultimate suffering and decision in you. And I think that's what Tiresias gets to, that place of ultimate suffering and decision, gets past the ruler into the 3 a.m. dream wakener-upper, and he wakens up to the fact that he has offended, and then he tries too late to change his decision.
Have you figured out why it is so many Irish writers are so drawn to what it is the Greeks have produced. Joyce was there, Yeats was there, you are there. I mean, is it there? Is it the power of myth that exists in their world? If you look at Greek mythology as we understand it, people are working out feuds and memories and anger from generations back. And I, from being an outsider, look at, in many ways, at the Irish doing the same thing.
Well, it's at the point, well, what Greek tragedy quite often is at the point where a kind of primal, unregenerate libido and energy is at a point of transition into civic forms, where libido becomes regulated by law, perhaps. And I think that a society like Ireland in the 20th century, which, I mean, it's moving towards a definition of itself. I mean, it's moving from being more or less a colony to being more or less an independent state, if independence is possible anymore. And it has been historically unfinished. There's an independent Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, 26 counties. There are 6 counties belong to Britain. There was frozen violence. Then there was naked violence, deadly violence. There is still what they call the peace process. There's an unfinished condition. So the common mind is receptive, and the common need is for, as Robert Frost would say, a momentary stay against confusion. The classics have staying power in two senses, I think, because they keep appealing to us and keep living. They stay in that sense because they have this other way of holding for a moment things in the mind for contemplation. Like in stays, as in a woman's undergarment, it bounds the condition for a moment, or it holds back something that's going to come to stay the confusion. So I think that there's an unfinished, confused, disputed condition politically in Ireland. There's also a religious change from religious to secular. The classics and the drama and the myth all helped us to get that into focus.
Thank you so much for coming in and spending an hour with us, Seamus Heaney. His latest work is The Burial at Thebes, a version of Sophocles' Antigone. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.